You're listening to the Thanks for Visiting podcast. We believe hosting with heart is at the core of every short-term rental. With Annette's background in business operation
and Sarah's extensive hospitality management and interior design experience, we have welcomed thousands of guests from over 30 countries, earning us over $1 million and garnering us thousands of five-star reviews.
We love sharing creative ways for your listing to stand out, serve your guests, and be profitable. Each episode, we will have knowledgeable guests who bring value to the short-term rental industry.
Or we will share our stories of our own experiences so you can implement actual improvements to your rentals. Whether you're experienced, new, or nervous to start your own short-term rental, we promise you'll feel right at home. Before we dive into the content, let's hear a word from our sponsor.
Choosing the right property management system is a big deal. And we did our research, tried different platforms, and for years, Hostly has been the best fit for our business.
It's not just a PMS. It's how we run everything. Managing listings across Airbnb, Vrbo, and Booking.com, easy. No double bookings, no stress.
And let's talk about guest experience. The custom guidebooks, they are game changer. Guests get check-in details, your house rules, and even favorite restaurants before they have to ask.
Plus, it integrates with everything. Guest screening, direct booking payments, and even in-house damage waivers, which you know we love. And their new Inbox AI, it pulls from your guidebooks and property details to help you answer guest questions faster.
And right now, TFE listeners get an even bigger discount. Hostly just upgraded your deal to $500 off onboarding.
Yep, that means if you sign up for an annual plan, your onboarding is completely free. If you go monthly, you get 50% off your onboarding fee.
So go to hostly.com/TFE and book your demo and grab the discount using code TFE500. The link will also be in the show notes.
Hello, welcome back to another great episode. My name is Sarah Karakayan.
I'm Annette Grant, and together we are
Thanks for visiting. Let's start this episode like we do each and every week, and that is celebrating one of you, our incredible listeners, who is heading on over to strshare.com. entering in the information about your short-term rental so that we can share you here on the podcast and on our Instagram account every Sunday. Annette, who are we sharing this week?
This week, we are sharing at Roost with a View. That's R-O-O-S-T, Roost with a View. And this is why it is so important to tell your story, let your guests know who you are. I am just beside myself with this story. And this is a highlight in their Instagram profile. So please go check it out. Like their profile, heart their property. And this is why I just love meeting all of the hosts. I love having this opportunity with STR Share, but I'm going to tell the story of Roost with a View. So how the Roost became, her name is Rena. She is a daydreamer, full of dreams and not so full of action. So she's telling us her faults, which you should be telling your short-term rentals if you're on your...
Because it makes you so relatable.
Yes. So she is a mom of three boys, a schoolie life dreamer, a web designer, and a camper. And in 2021, one of her boys, Finn, was diagnosed with cancer. It's one of those experiences where you realize life is short and you need to start living it. So just, Finn is doing awesome and he has finished his treatment. But after that, she decided it was time to start living and take some chances. She bought the Roost in March of 2024 and have been working on it to make it a peaceful, relaxing getaway. A place people can relax, escape the daily hustle, and regroup. The Roost really calms your mind, body, and soul. And so she hopes that you go for your dreams, maybe come stay at the Roost so you can relax, clear your mind, and think about your life, your dreams, and hatch a plan to go get them. P.S. In the near future, she also plans to offer free stays to the Long Island pediatric cancer patients and their families. Rena, that's what it's all about. She took action on her dreams. So pumped to share her on the show. So please go ahead, give them a follow. Go stay if you are in the, it's in the Catskills. So if you're planning a vacation or anybody in your world, send them to Roost with a View. Thanks for coming to STR Share, Rena, and sharing not only your property, but your story. And wow, way to go. Way to take action. Well, we are pumped for you.
This is what it means when you hear that. Simon Sinek said it, but I think a lot of people like Annette and me repeat it. And I want to make sure you understand it. which is people don't buy what you do. They buy why you're doing it. So there are so many short-term rentals out there to choose from, especially in the Catskills. But when you put your story out there, like Rena did, your heart more than likely gets pulled to this family. Like, I want to support this. Like, I want to be a part of this story. And so that's the why people choose to. And there's nothing wrong with sharing that information because people want to be a part of that sort of ecosystem. You know, if you're not comfortable sharing, like, that's okay too. But this was important to Rena. And I don't know about you, but like, I'm here to support that family and be a part of their journey and them living out their dreams. So that's what that means. And I think that's why it's not enough to just do the short-term rental. If you can put a little bit of yourself into it, or your family, or your why that you're doing it, you can really stand out from the crowd. So with that, let's move on to our interview today with the incredible Amanda Hahn, who is, I feel like Annette and I are always saying, we're not CPAs, disclaimer. Yeah,
but today we're talking taxes.
Yes, and Amanda wowed us. We saw her, well, we've known about her for a while because she's just very popular amongst the Bigger Pockets world, people who are on Bigger Pockets. We saw her speak at a conference and she impressed us. And she's just the nicest and most generous person when it comes to sharing information about taxes. So she is a CPA and a tax strategist who specializes in helping people use real estate to save massive amounts in taxes and keep their hard-earned money. She's the founder of Keystone CPA, and she helps to educate investors on how to maximize tax write-offs, legal entity strategies, tax-efficient ways to access profit, how to use 401k money for real estate, and so much more. And she tells you in the interview today that she grew up with real estate, and she, because of that, she wanted nothing to do with it. But of course, it found her, as it does. And she's really going to go over today tax mistakes that short-term rental hosts make. And you'll never believe this, how a lot of CPAs get it wrong too. So this episode is so important for you to listen to. And then if you're working with a CPA and you don't quite feel confident that they know your full story or the tax strategies and the tax law as it pertains to you and your short-term rental, you got to give it a listen, take some notes, and make some appointments with them. Amanda, welcome to the show. Could you tell our audience in your own words a little bit about yourself, your experience with short-term rentals, and why you are the go-to expert?
I feel like that kind of just fell in my lap. So I am actually the third generation of real estate investors in my family. So my grandparents dabbled in real estate. My grandparents are pretty heavy in real estate, and my parents dabbled in real estate. And I sort of grew up not wanting to ever do real estate because my grandparents were really like hands-on landlords. I kind of grew up around that. And so I went to school, got my license as a CPA, and I ended up working for one of the big four public accounting firms. I happened to end up in the real estate group. So that's sort of what opened my eyes to what, you know, the tax benefits could be for real estate investors. And when my husband and I started out our journey to invest in real estate ourselves was when we started meeting sort of everyday investors. And we came to the realization that most investors don't understand that there are tax strategies that could be used, that tax savings is a thing, you know, kind of tend to think that taxes is something that just happens to us. That sort of started us on a journey to specialize in working with real estate investors. And as short-term rentals became more and more popular in the last decade, we sort of just became one of the go-to people on how to use that to save on taxes.
And you say that term, save on taxes. And I mean, I'm on LinkedIn and every day it is just like, I'm just going to say it. There are a ton of bros on LinkedIn. Oh, if you have a giant W-2, like buy a short-term rental, it can reduce your taxes, you know, by, you know, 50%. But in general, like that's noisy to me because I think it's overblown. And they're over-promising and under-delivering on what those savings could be. I just don't even listen to it anymore. So why should we all care about taxes and specifically short-term rental taxes? Make me care at a higher level than just the noise that I am hearing via social media.
Yeah, that's interesting because I totally understand what you're saying. I feel like the short-term rental has become kind of the buzzword, right, for tax savings. And part of it is a little bit overplayed. But to take a step back and say, okay, why do we care about taxes at all? Because I think most people think taxes is something that sort of just happens to us. We hate it, but we kind of have to deal with it. Sort of, it is what it is. Only super rich people can avoid taxes. But when you really think about it, there's only one set of the tax code, right? It's the same code. There's not like different law. So the law is exactly the same. But the difference is that if you're someone who understands how to use it to your benefit, then you can pay less tax. And why is paying less taxes important? Well, studies show that Americans lose more money to taxes than we do on food, clothing, and housing combined. So I
Wow.
think people tend to think like, yeah, like if you're someone who makes $500,000, you're probably doing pretty well. Have a lot of cash to invest. But the reality is the people who make $500,000 or more, if they don't have the right strategies, they probably end up netting a similar amount of income than somebody who maybe just owns rental properties, making $200,000. And so that's why it's really, really important for us to really care about this thing that nobody likes to talk about, which is, taxes. And I think one of my passions is really just letting people know that there are things you can do to control your taxes. It's not just something that happens to you. If you do the right things during the year, it's definitely possible to save on tax. And short-term rental is one of the very few ways that works for virtually everyone to reduce their taxes.
Why is that, Amanda? Like, is there a reason why our, like the IRS or the tax system like actually favors short-term rentals? Or why are, and why is there a loophole? Like, what is it about short-term rentals that is so special?
I honestly feel like it's a mistake. And that's why I actually call it a loophole. I don't think that was the intention of the tax law. So if we have time for a little bit of history. So before, many years ago, if you invested in real estate, or, even today, when you invest in rental real estate, not only do we get to take write-offs against our income like a business owner, right? Our car expenses, home office, education, things like that. Not only do we get to write those off, but we also get to take what's called depreciation. And that's, basically we get to write off the purchase price of our building over time. And so when you put together all these different write-offs and depreciation, oftentimes what happens is you have a property that cash flows pretty well, but for tax purposes, you actually show a loss. So the question becomes, well, what happens with that tax loss? Can I use it to offset taxes from my rental income? And then can I also use it to offset taxes from, let's say, my W-2 job if I'm still working full time? And the reason the short-term rental is called a loophole is because if we're talking about traditional real estate investments, like a long-term rental, and that could be a single-family, multifamily, commercial real estate, usually they're long-term tenants. Most people cannot use these tax losses against their W-2 income unless they or they're married to a real estate professional. And there's a handful of rules of like, how do you become a real estate professional for tax purposes? One of which is, though, you have to have more time in real estate than your job. And so you can see that it's very difficult for somebody who works full time, 2,000 hours at least, to have more than 2,000 hours in their long-term rentals and be able to kind of create real estate loss and offset W-2ing. And so again, the reason the short-term rental is called a loophole is because when you invest in short-term rentals, IRS actually does not need you to become a real estate professional. In other words, you don't have to quit your job. You don't have to have more time in real estate than your job. You could potentially use the losses against W-2 income as long as you meet material participation hours.
Okay. So material participation hours and a real estate professional are two different things. They're two different concepts.
They're two different concepts. They're somewhat interrelated, but if we're talking specifically about short-term rentals, the one thing to remember is we don't care about real estate professional status at all. You only care about material participation hours. And this is a mistake area that we see not just investors get confusion on, but also CPAs and even the IRS. because it sort of makes no sense, right? Kind of like, why is short-term rentals different? Why is there such a loophole? There's really no rhyme or reason. It's just kind of, it is what it is, until maybe one day they close up the loophole.
Right. That's what I was going to say. It's, you led in with, it might be, you know, more largely a mistake, like that probably just wasn't a sector of real estate when the tax code was being written, that maybe there was pause there of real estate professional versus material time. So essentially thinking these could change over time, like this loophole might adjust if people aren't taking, you know, advantage of it. But I want to ask some questions that I still am trying to understand myself. So you are saying, you know, those losses from your property, if it's cash flowing well. Well, if it's cash flowing well, how are their losses? Is it the depreciation? Because that doesn't make sense to me. Well, I'm cash flowing, I'm doing well. How do I have losses?
Yeah, and that's a common misconception for people. When we talk about loss, we're only talking about tax loss, right? So we're never investing on a poor performing property just to get the tax benefit. And so, yes, the losses are two main things. One is making sure you maximize your write-offs. I think investors are always good at writing off interest, property taxes, management fees. But what a lot of people overlook are some of these overhead costs, like the business use of your personal car, right? We're not, not just driving to the property, but driving to real estate meetups, driving to meet with your CPA, your attorney, all those different things.
Okay.
You know, your home office, joining real estate masterminds, buying real estate books. So all those things are kind of like expenses you have anyways, but now we're just kind of turning them from personal costs into legitimate business write-offs. So yes, your property is still cash flowing, but for tax purposes, now you have all these added write-offs that are bringing down the taxable income. And of course, the depreciation is the big one, right? With depreciation, you can not only depreciate the property, but we also are depreciating all the furniture, all of the supplies, the Pelotons, the TVs that you're putting into your Airbnbs. And so those are what creates oftentimes the tax loss that we're talking about.
When you were mentioning real estate books, the personal car, you know, real estate masterminds, do those have to, if the IRS is looking at this, do those purchases need to take place on the short-term rental business like that card, or can it be on your personal, or is there a division that it should happen on?
Yeah, that's a great question. What we typically recommend is if you own your real estate in LLC, you know, for liability protection purposes, then we want those charges to happen in the LLC's bank account or credit card.
Okay.
It helps from a, you know, liability protection perspective, and also for taxes, it's cleaner.
Okay.
Now, we do have investors who maybe don't have an LLC, or they're just not as good as using it, so they're putting some of those expenses on a personal card. That's fine, too. What the IRS will look for if you're audited is they want to make sure you're able to prove those expenses have business purposes. Right. So, yes, I mean, if you join a real estate mastermind, it's pretty clear it's for real estate. I mean, people might love you guys, want to hang out, but the main purpose of that is for real estate.
Right.
And I'll say alternatively, just because you have an LLC for your rentals, you can't just, you know, go to the spa with your friends and put it on the LLC card and call it a write-off.
Right.
At the heart of it, it's about establishing the business purpose of whatever expense we're talking about.
We meet with hosts every day. You know, all day long. And one of the hardest parts of being a host is keeping the bank account separate. I mean, every host we talk to, they have receipts from whether they're commingling accidentally because they go to Costco, or heck, Sarah and I do it. Like, we're on an Amazon account. Oh, we were on the wrong Amazon account. We put it on our personal. We forgot to put it on the property. What happened? I mean, it just seems like no matter what guardrails we put in place, there are expenses that are being mingled, commingled. What's the discussion? What's the, like, keeping those things separate? Or a lot of times it's like, oh my gosh, we just needed to get stuff done and I needed to get that contractor a check or cash, so I just pulled it out of my personal account. What happens when you feel so overwhelmed, you don't even know where to start because it started as a personal home and then it went to a short-term rental, or, you know, all the things just get commingled? And it's very common. I think every host listening can feel that pain of like, I don't even know what's what. What do you advise your clients on how to clean that up or, you know, move forward after they feel like they've kind of dug themselves this like expense hole that they don't know how to like get out of making sure they're in the right buckets?
Yeah, I mean, it's never too late to start. And I'll tell you that I think the reason people commingle, like you said, there's a contractor, I need to pay him today. Here's my personal checkbook. I would say that the majority of the reason these commingling occur is because your accounts are not properly funded. Okay. Mm. So meaning I have an LLC account, there's $500 in there. I need to pay an invoice for $1,200. There's no money, therefore I'm paying it here. But if my LLC account is always well-funded, like I always have a cushion of $5,000 from my personal into that account, I replenish it when it goes beyond $4,000, then you're less likely to have these kinds of issues happen because there's always money in that account, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's just a matter of setting up the systems so that there's enough funds in there. You mentioned Costco. That's a common one, like even for me too. So like for me, I have like a really tiny wallet and my wallet is a personal card and a business card. So even at Costco, I have two transactions for checkout. If it's for the office or work stuff, I use one card and my next transaction is my own card. Amazon. So my little trick is in Amazon, you have a default card. Like we have just the same account, but you pay with different cards. My default card is my business card because I always want to remind myself, like, is this something business? Mm-hmm. And if it's not business, then, you know, you manually put it on the personal card. So just little things like that. I mean, what works for one investor might not work for another. But I would say at a baseline, make sure you have a different bank account for your investment properties separate from personal. Even if you don't have an LLC, right? I would have Amanda Hahn's personal account and just Amanda Hahn Real Estate, that I'll call it, and try to use that because that makes things so much easier for you, bookkeeping time, tax time. Don't have to go through thousands of transactions to pick out what's business, what's personal.
And I know that just because I say we chat with hosts all the time, there's a lot of hosts out there right now. They've already booked, you know, tons of reservations for this year. Maybe they've had guests, they've already been, and they have. It's a personal account. So do you think just like they have to draw the line in the sand, open up the business account and start fund it and then just start fresh? Like you got to just, it doesn't matter if it's the middle of the year, after the first quarter, just start, correct? Like it's okay. Like, I feel like a lot of people want it to be this like beginning of the year. I know all the charges. So as a CPA, what would you like your client just like, hey, as soon as they can, what would you like to see them do to triage?
Sooner rather than later, because, you know, if we're spending on the personal bank account, you're paying all sorts of things going through. If you have kids, you know, there's lots of stuff. So if even starting today, you have a new bank account for your real estate, well, bookkeeping is much, much simpler between now and even the end of the year, right? Because we have that bank statement we're going to pull, we know what the deposits are, income or money I funded. And then the expenses are all business expense. Why? Because when I spent the money, I have already designated that to be paid from this specific account.
I want to go back to the difference between being a real estate, qualifying to be a real estate professional versus the material participation. So we need to understand the difference between the two of them as short-term rental investors. So what are those differences?
Well, so I would say first and foremost, if our audience is only investing in short-term rentals, okay, then we don't even need to talk about real estate professional status because that's not relevant. Okay. And, I was mentioning earlier that actually this is probably one of the most common tax mistake areas I see even from CPAs. So here's a tip for our audience, okay? If you invest in short-term rentals and you talk to your CPA and they tell you, oh, you're not going to get a benefit because you're not a real estate professional, that is the number one warning sign you're working with the wrong person. If you invest in short-term rentals and your CPA says anything about real estate professional, then they don't understand the short-term rental loophole, because the loophole is that you don't need to be, right? So if that's not a requirement, why are we even talking?
Okay, great. So what is material participation then?
Yes. So we only care about material participation. So material participation, there's a couple ways to qualify. There's actually seven ways. we'll share the top three because the other ones, you know, virtually nobody really qualifies. So material participation, I'll give you the hours requirements and then I'll kind of define what those mean.
Okay.
So the first one is you, and if you're married, a spouse combined, have at least 500 hours on your short-term rentals. Okay, so you, and if you're married, both of you have 500 hours on the short-term rentals. Then you've met material participation, which means create rental losses, offset W-2, business, all types of income. If you don't have 500 hours, another way to qualify is if you have at least 100 hours on the short-term rentals and nobody else has more time than you. So that would be like my cleaning crew had 80 hours, I had 120. Great, mm-hmm. I've met material participation. Now keep in mind, it is you against all other, like each other individual. So you also have to compare your time against like the gardener, against the contractor, against, you know, each other person. So, and then the third way to potentially qualify is you have any number of hours, but your hours are more than everyone else combined. So in this scenario, we're adding up the hours of cleaning crew, gardener, landscaper, contractor. If they total 30 and you had 60, then you also met material participation. So any one of those three allows you to then use rental losses against all types of income.
What if I have hired a property manager, but I'm still spending time on my property? Could I still qualify for the material participation? Is that a red flag to the IRS? I'm like, wait, why do you have a property manager and you're getting material participation?
Yeah, it certainly would be subject to more questioning if you're audited, right? Because if a property manager is doing a lot of this stuff, the question becomes, what is it that you're doing?
Okay.
But I would say it does not mean because you have a property manager, you cannot meet material participation. You just want to be smart about what are they doing versus what are you doing? I think it's important to define, like, what are these hours, right? What counts as hours? What does not count as hours? So for material participation, the hours that the IRS looks for is things that you're doing that impact the day-to-day operations of your short-term rental. And so what would not count would be learning about how to invest, looking for properties, deal analysis, right? Those kinds of things, going to a conference, because those don't impact directly the day-to-day operations. Things that do count is you setting up your property, staging it, furnishing it, handling guest inquiries, coordinating contractors, cleaning crew, you cleaning it. All those things are, you know, that impact the day-to-day operations are what is material participation hours.
How do you recommend short-term rental hosts track these hours so that should they get audited, they're like, well, here's my proof that I have 500 hours. Is it like a spreadsheet with like, or is a Google Calendar where you say like, working on my STR? Like, how do you see that being most successful?
There are specific things you need to track. So you need to track the date, the number of hours, which property is it for, and what the task is. And the methodology itself is pretty flexible. I always tell people it's whatever methodology works for you. You know, because unlike bookkeeping, right, you can have a bookkeeper track your books, but hours are typically tracked by you. I rarely have clients who have somebody else track their hours. And so it's got to be something that works for you. You know, a lot of our clients, we give them like an Excel. So they put it into Google Sheet, pick it up on their phone. One of our clients actually created an app to track it. It's called Reps Tracker, R-E-P-S Tracker.
Okay.
So that's like a really cool one that tracks long-term and short-term rentals separately. It's like there's two different modules, right?
Cool.
Two different things. Yeah. And so, calendar is fine as well. Calendar is a little bit harder. It depends how you use it.
Mm-hmm.
But you just want to make sure you have those, property, address, time, date, how many hours you spent on it.
If you have more than one property, do you have to meet 500 hours per property to take off the loss from that property, or is it holistically?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so typically the default rule is you have to meet material participation for each property. However, we can make what's called a grouping election. So grouping election then allows you to tell the IRS, hey, I've got five short-term rentals. I'm grouping them together for hours purposes, right? Just for hours. I'm not combining them in real life.
Mm-hmm.
For hours purposes, I want to group them together to meet material participation hours. Mm. And so this works really well for a lot of our clients who maybe don't always invest locally, right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's say it's somebody in Arizona who has a bunch of rentals in Florida. And so what you could do is your Florida short-term rentals could be fully property manager managed. I don't do anything with them at all. But if I have one property that's local or close enough where I can self-manage, now, as long as I have 500 hours, I group everything together. I do accelerated depreciation. Now I can use all of the losses against my W-2 income.
And then to qualify for material participation, do you have to own a certain percentage of the LLC or the entity that it's in? So like, let's say you own 50% of a property, but then someone you're not married to owns the other 50%. Do you still have the 500 hours to qualify to offset?
So in a partnership scenario, that works fine. So let's say you and I are partners in an LLC and we decide to, you know, I mean, I want to use the loophole. You also want to use the loophole. As long as we are separately going after the 500 hours requirement, that should be fine. There's typically no issues around that. The issue typically comes in if we're trying to use one of the other requirements. So remember, 500 is just one of them. Right. I can also try to use the 100 and more time than anyone else. But you can see logically that doesn't make sense. Like, I cannot have more than you and you also have more than me.
Right.
So in the partnership scenario, I think the facts that we see most often is we're in a deal together. I spend a little bit of time. You spend more time. But it's where like I use the 100 hours on this one, but maybe you have 500 across your other short-term rental. That could work as well.
Can accelerated depreciation ever work against you? Let's say you buy a short-term rental, you'd use it to sell accelerated depreciation, and you sell it in 24 months. Like, are there repercussions for over leveraging these tax loopholes, and then you're having to pay it because you accelerated too fast?
And maybe you share, Amanda, to someone who doesn't know what that means. Like, what is accelerated depreciation?
Yeah.
How is it different than regular depreciation? And then answer and ask the question.
Yeah. Love it. So the tax code allows us to take depreciation. And it's under the premise that your building is going to have wear and tear over time. So my $500,000 building is not always going to be like fully there. I mean, in reality, it is, but wear and tear. So you're allowed to write it off. Usually for short-term rentals, you write off over 39 years. And so every year you take the building purchase price divided by 39. That's the amount of paper write-off that you get to take every year. Now, what the tax law also allows us to do is to say, well, this whole thing, the structure is not just a building. Right? I can go in and analyze or break out what makes up that $500,000 building. So breaking it out into specialty plumbing, specialty electrical, cabinets, certain types of flooring. And when they break out those components, then your CPA can help you calculate faster depreciation because those have, you know, wear and tear long, you know, much faster than 39 years. So if it's 5 years, then I'm, instead of writing it off over 39, I can write it off a lot faster. And that's where you see people who say, well, I bought a $500,000 building and my first year write-off is like $150,000, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's because they've accelerated a lot of it. I think people tend to hear the narrative, kind of like what you were saying earlier, Anand, about, you know, just like I save 50% in taxes. And what investors will do is they'll go out and just do a cost segregation study. Mm-hmm. Like, pay someone, let's get it done, great. The issue is if you do it too early and you do it in a year where you can't actually use it, for example, you did any material participation, you just heard this big write-off and went out and did it. What happens is that the loss actually gets trapped, is what we call passive losses. Okay. We do see this somewhat frequently. So you create this $150,000 loss. You cannot use it against W-2 because you're not material participating. And you think, well, next year I'll just materially participate. Well, guess what? That 150 is trapped. It is always and forever a passive loss. The fact that you meet the hours the following year, that doesn't change anything in the past, right? We don't change history. So that gets trapped. So what I always tell people is before you get a cost segregation study, step one is to figure out, can I actually use it, right? Do I meet material participation? If yes, then let's see what's the benefit of a cost segregation study. Those are kind of the steps. And I think something you mentioned, like if I'm going to sell the property in a year or two or in 6 months, do I do a cost segregation study? The answer is it depends. It depends on a lot of different things, like what's your tax rate next year? What else is going on next year? What is the tax law next year? To then decide whether it makes sense for me to take a big write-off this year and potentially pay taxes on that next year if I'm not going to 1031 exchange.
Right. And what if you accelerate all the depreciation and your material participation is there? And so you're like, okay, I'm taking 150 this year, 150, 150. And after those 3 years, what happens to that tax loophole? You don't have any of the accelerated depreciation anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, does the depreciation go away? Like, how is it, like, did you use it all up in those first 3 years? And then I don't know about everyone else, but you want to be earning more money year over year, whether it's in your W-2 or on your property. So it's like, are you just compounding that tax liability after you've accelerated this depreciation so fast? What happens?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is, even with cost segregation, there is always still depreciation over the next 39 years, because it's not possible to say there's no building.
Okay.
And that's why on a $500,000 building, it's never a $500,000 write-off, right? Because they're still building. We're just trying to take, in my example, if we took $150,000 immediately, there's still $300,000 roughly that you're going to depreciate over the rest of the ownership of the property. It's just lower than if you had waited evenly over 39 years. So most investors, you still will get a good amount of depreciation year after year. But yes, what we typically see is, you know, if you are continuing to cash flow, most people will continue to build their portfolio, right? So that's buying more properties. And so you'll have the newer properties to then offset the W-2 income for that specific year. I kind of tend to tell clients, it's sort of an addiction. That it's kind of like the first time somebody gets a big refund check or ends up not having to pay taxes, they're like, wow, this is amazing. I'm going to take my taxes saved. I'm going to put a down payment on another rental property. And then after a couple of years, it's like, wow. Then you come to a year where like, well, I didn't really want to buy this year, and you have to pay the tag. And it's like, ouch, you know, now I remember what it was like to pay taxes. Sort of becomes an addiction. Healthy or unhealthy, I don't know. You have to be the judge of that.
Well, right, because you're saying that. And I'm like, well, then you're just putting, obviously, more properties, more liability, more, you know, it's like, it's this, you have to think about what the future, like what you really want your future to look like. Are you continuing to build this portfolio? Because that's not going to come without its own issues, pressure, you know, other things. It's like we're chasing. Yeah. Sarah and I, we actually talk about this a lot of like, we do feel like people are always kind of chasing these like tax loopholes or these breaks. And it's like, well, some point, like, when does it, like, the buck stops here at some point in time? Like, either you are going to, I don't know, sell your portfolio and then have the tax event there. It's like kind of choosing when you'll have that taxable event, right? Is that what like ends up happening?
And I think it's just taking if we're talking about like a very long-term look, right? Because most investors, at least the ones that we work with, if you've built your wealth on real estate, even eventually when you sell, most people will still have it parked in real estate. It just might not be something you're actively involved in. It might be something more passive. It might be 100% managed by someone else. But we have very few clients who decide, gosh, I built this whole portfolio, and now in retirement, I'm just going to sell it and go 100% into stocks or crypto. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like that's what people know they're comfortable with. Going from more active real estate in your working years to more passive real estate in your retirement years, and then ultimately passing it off to the next generation. Mm-hmm. So when you do that, you get step up basis. So nobody pays kind of the recapture taxes in an ideal world. But of course, there's always times when it's like, yeah, I got to sell this property. So we'll deal with the taxes. It is what it is. That's what we typically see. But, you know, and short-term rental specifically too, a lot of our clients use it more so as like a one or two specific strategy. So we was just talking to a client a couple of days ago that had a business exit. So they sold their business to private equity for a lot of money. So for them, we planned a couple years ago for them to start acquiring short-term rentals. They didn't have time to do any material participation, but we wanted enough in their portfolio so that when their business was sold, that was the year they exited. They have time to manage their short-term rentals, get a bunch of losses to offset that huge tax liability on the business sale. Now, are they going to continue doing that now that, you know, are they just going to do it for the 1 year? That's still up in the air.
Interesting. That's which is why it's so important to work with a CPA who understands, and Amanda, too, that their CPA, even if they understand short-term rentals and real estate, the client understands that you need to share with your CPA a holistic picture about your life and like what you plan to do, because that's where that strategy comes in. Had they not shared with their CPA that they're planning on having this, the sale of the business where all this cash flow is going to come in, and thinking ahead like that, they may not have had the time to be strategic. Because I think a lot of us talk about the here and now, and we don't really talk about the future planning with our CPA. Maybe the CPA isn't asking, but what do you say to that, to anyone's listening who doesn't have that kind of relationship with their CPA? We're like, well, I'm supposed to tell them like all the things I'm dreaming and hoping for the next. And how far ahead do you share that information with your CPA?
Yeah, it's funny because I don't know. I always tell people like, wait, the real way to save on taxes, like, it is not when you're filing your taxes for last year. That's what people tend to think. Like, I don't even have a CPA. Real tax planning actually happens outside of that time, right? Because it's forward looking, and it's not super scary. It's not real tax planning is not just like me grilling someone about their numbers. It's really just very conversational, you know, like, well, what's, you know, like what I always start with, like, what's going on? Because I just want you to free flow. What is going on? Because then people talk about the most, you know, unexpected things, like, well, I'm traveling. And so it's in those, like, just conversations that your tax person can help you curate what are some of the potential opportunity areas, or what are some of the, like, hey, did you know that if you were to do this thing you're planning that you would actually owe a bunch of taxes? So we're talking about it now before you do it so that you can save. But I think that's the ideal, right? The ideal is just a casual conversation where your CPA can kind of get into your head on what you want to do this year, next year, and however far ahead you know that you can communicate to them. And then the strategies will come as a result of what you plan to do. But I think what most people actually do in their tax planning, if they actually do it, is it's actually a Q&A. So they'll listen to, you know, like a podcast like this. They'll write down all the stuff. They'll call their CPA, meet with them and be like, you know, should I do a cost segregation? What is material participation? And just, and that's okay. That's better than not doing it at all. But just understand that's simply a Q&A where you are bringing questions and they're answering questions. There's not a lot of like forward planning. It's still just very restricted to, here's my questions, please answer them.
Right. You know how we're always on the hunt for awesome furniture, decor, and supplies for our short-term rentals?
We're going to let you in on our secret weapon, Manoan. They are a free platform for hosts that offers steep discounts on over 150 top brands. Think Wayfair, Article, Our House, Liza, Parachute, California Design In, Public Goods, and Society 6. Plus, the ability to centralize all ordering and reordering needs to make tracking and bookkeeping a breeze.
I had my eye on gorgeous linens from Parachute, wanting to give our listing that wow factor with better quality that lasts. And my Manoan discount actually made it more cost-effective over the long run than the budget options requiring constant replacement. Seeing the savings, I naturally had to order more. All I had to do was head to their site, install their browser extension, which makes shopping so, so simple, and add items across partner brands to my cart with just a few clicks.
And when guests inevitably ask you about that awesome Lisa mattress that you purchased through Manoan, at a major discount, no less, you can point them to a custom digital storefront called Manoan Showroom. The best part? When guests shop their stay, you'll earn commission from hundreds of stores, including featured items you didn't purchase through Manoan.
So head over to Manoan.com/TFV_podcast or simply click the link in our show notes to sign up. Let the savings and the earnings begin. What are some of the other tax mistakes you see short-term rental investors making? Are there any others that we haven't covered?
I think we, you know, we kind of talked about not maximizing write-offs, right? Just not understanding what we can write off, not tracking it, separating it correctly, understanding the short-term rental loophole. I don't know that I would call that an investor mistake. It's probably more of a CPA mistake, right? Because investors don't really know.
Yeah.
But I think if you invest in short-term rentals, you for sure want to track your hours if you're anywhere close to one of these three potential loopholes that we were talking about. I think those are kind of the more common ones that some of the more common ones we see. Oh, another one. We didn't really talk about legal entities. This super common, but I do see it from time to time, that for some reason, investors tend to think short-term rentals is like an active business. So I've seen people, whether they did it themselves or CPA advised incorrectly, to hold the rental property in a corporation, like an S-corp, rather than an LLC. So really important to understand that short-term rentals are still just rental property, and we never want to hold rental real estate in corporations. So your short-term rental should be in an LLC, personal name, but not in an S corporation. Okay. If you do co-hosting or you manage other people's properties, then maybe, you know, like the management income could go into an S corp, but the property, the title of the property, have it remain in an LLC.
What about, there's a lot of conversations around midterm rentals, Amanda. I always joke with our audience that, like, they're not, I don't think they're the easy button. They're still, they take a lot of work to get the right person in there. But even though it's furnished, that does not make it a short-term rental, correct?
Yes. So short-term rental for tax purposes is a property where the average guest stay is 7 days or less. Okay. So that's it. That's the only thing we care about. We don't care if it's on Airbnb or, you know, you direct listing. And so we sometimes see property where it's a midterm for part of the year, and then it's very short term for the rest of the year. So as long as the average guests stay 7 days or less, then you can use the short-term rental tax loophole. I think a question I get all the time is, well, can midterm rental investors use the short-term rental loophole? Generally not, right? Midterm, typically they're 30 days or more. I mean, you're trying to get to even more than 30 days. So typically they're not part of the short-term rental.
Is there any other strategy tax-wise where midterm rentals would win out over short-term, or is it simply you're not, yeah, what do you think to that?
Sure. Well, you know, like anything in taxes, there's not a one-size-fits-all. I know we just spend all of our time talking about how amazing short-term rentals are and the loophole. We actually have clients we advise against having it as a short term. So meaning if you do short term, I want the average guest stay to be longer than 7 days. Who is that good for? Somebody who's a real estate professional. So if you are a real estate professional because you own a bunch of long term rentals, you already self-manage your rentals, then it's easier if your short term rentals are treated like long term rentals, right? With average guest stay of 7 days or more. Because then you don't need to separately meet material participation for this one property. You can group it together with all of your long-term rentals. You already naturally can use all the losses.
I love that.
And the midterm rental, like, is a better time of midterm rental? That would be a good example as well. Like, maybe I'll operate as a midterm because it's all part of real estate professional bucket.
Perfect. Any other questions? I mean, so many, but yeah. What if you filed your taxes and you're like, wait, I had material participation. I didn't take advantage like I should have. Can you do an amended tax? Like, or, hey, I was working. Like, maybe there's someone out there, they had this conversation with their CPA. The CPA was like, well, you're not a real estate professional. And they kind of just, it happens, you know, like, all right, fine, check the box, turned it in. And now they're like listening to this and it's like, holy smokes, I told them. I was like, there, I should have been able to use this tax loophole. How can we go back? I feel like a lot of people think like taxes are final and that's it. What if we want to go back and see if we could have been taking advantage of some things that we haven't been taking advantage of over the past couple of years? Is it possible?
It's possible to go back. Yeah, it is possible to go back, but it involves a much deeper level of analysis I'll tell you why. The reasons are, if you go back, first and foremost, there's potentially higher audit risk,
right?
Because when you go back, you're going to do an amended return. You have to tell IRS, why am I amending? What changed? So you're actually prompting them to tell them, like, this is something that changed.
Okay.
And especially if the amendment is to, if the amendment is to actually claim a large refund, that's an even higher audit risk because now they're going to.
Right.
There are certain things in the tax world we can amend for and certain things that we can't, even like for cost segregation, right? Because one of the benefits of maybe amending is, gosh, I didn't do accelerated depreciation. I'm going to do that and real estate professional or short-term loophole and do all that. But there are certain things, certain types of assets where we cannot go back and amend for the cost segregation. So those little things, like that's more technical, like should I do it? How much benefit am I going to get?
Sure.
The good news, though, is you can always catch up on a go-forward basis. So meaning this is the first time you ever heard about it. Gosh, I always knew I qualify, but I only took regular depreciation. Well, before you file this year's taxes, what you can do is you can claim material participation. If you didn't do accelerated depreciation, you can catch up for what you didn't do in the past and do it all this coming tax return.
Okay.
So it's just a matter of weighing when we work with clients who kind of missed out on those things. We have to help them weigh out. Is it better to amend or is it better to just catch it up on going forward? What's kind of the cost benefit of each of those decisions?
Okay. So it's not all lost. Can you give us, I had talked about what I see all over LinkedIn. Like, can you give us, what is an average, like what is a good, you know, obviously no names, I think, but what is a very common strategy that you see that, hey, they have a W-2 and they're making X, you know, is it a couple? Is it normally a couple? Is it like, can you give us a scenario of this tax saving when they purchase, they have the material participation, what have you seen save, some mm-hmm. savings? What do you, if you can give us an example, very common.
Yeah, I mean, and every year is a little bit different. We didn't talk about bonus depreciation, but currently we have 40% bonus depreciation. So what that means is like when you take accelerated depreciation, not only are you doing it faster, but we add this layer of bonus depreciation on top of it to make it like even faster. There are talks right now of bringing back 100% bonus depreciation to 2025. Whether that comes back or not is anyone's guess, but let's assume, well, we can talk about two scenarios. Let's assume that there is no, you know, we just keep the current law. So I was just talking to a cost segregation firm yesterday, actually. So right now, if it's like a $100,000 building, generally you're expecting about $20,000 in first year depreciation on the high end. So, you know, as you scale up, the higher the property building, you kind of use those same ratio, right? Roughly 20%.
Okay.
Back when we had 100% bonus depreciation, those were maybe 30% roughly. So on a $100,000 property, maybe $30,000 in first year depreciation. And you kind of go up from there. Now, keep in mind, this is just the building. And for short-term rental investors, it's more than just buying the property, right? So it's all the furniture and all that that's eligible for depreciation as well. So, and then, you know, those numbers, you just kind of multiply by whatever tax rate that person is in. So if they're in a, you know, if it's $100,000 of a write-off, they're in a 37% tax bracket, and that's $37,000 in taxes saved. So it's kind of a really high level rule of thumb to figure out how much savings can you get from a property.
Okay. Do you have to do the cost segregation, though, to have the accelerated and bonus depreciation?
You don't. So you can take accelerated. So let's say you're somebody who you bought a short-term rental and you're rehabbing it yourself. So you did all of the new cabinets and all that. You already know the cost of the plumbing and all that. Your CPA could just, you know, take faster depreciation because they already know what it is. You spent the money on it. Cost segregation generally is for the acquisition side, the building itself. You bought the building, unless you're an engineer, you probably don't know what the components are and that you can't assign a value. So that's what it is.
Got it.
Yeah. All right, Amanda, if someone is loving this conversation and they want to learn more about you, what services are you offering? Can they reach out to you? What does that look like?
Yes. My company is called Keystone CPA. So you can go to keystonecpa.com. We have a lot of great free information on there. We actually created a tool. It's a tax risk assessment. And because when we teach all over the U.S., people are always asking us, like, how do I know if I'm overpaying in taxes? I heard you speak. I'm kind of anxious now. I don't even know if I'm overpaying. And so the tax risk assessment is a self-assessment with a handful of questions. You answer those and you get a score at the end of it. And if you did well, you score high, that's good. Right? You feel a little bit better. Like, I've covered all the areas that Amanda says I should have talked about. And if you scored low, that's okay too. You can print out your results. And when you meet with your tax person, you can show it to them and say, hey, here are all the things I said no to. Maybe that's a starting point, you know, to like, can we chat through some of these things? So you can check that out on my website. And best place to find me if you are looking for daily tax tips, probably Instagram as Amanda Hahn CPA. And I also have a YouTube channel for those of you who really want to dive in deeper into tax strategies.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of those things. It's like you said, daily tax tips. I encourage follow Amanda because you never know which one's actually going to stick or like light that light bulb off. And it might, taxes might not be your thing, but it's like just having that. Okay, I know I'm probably following the wrong people on LinkedIn, but have the positive side of like, where can I like use this? What can I understand? It doesn't have to be this all or nothing. I think that's what we think about when we think about our numbers and taxes. It's like either I understand it or I don't. And that's not where we're at. It's like, how can you just get a little bit better, you know, this year and then the next year and the next year? I think that's a lot of people throw their hands up of like, oh, I don't like taxes. I don't like numbers. It's like, well, just start to learn just a little bit better can make a really big difference, especially most of the people listening to the show, I hope, are long-term investors. And so if they didn't get the win this year, they can get that win next year. So please, yeah, give Amanda that follow so you can get those daily tax tips for sure.
I think a question I get asked a lot is like, you know, when do I know if I should do tax planning? You know, is it like, how many properties should I own before I do tax planning, or how much income should I be making? And it's really not about that. You know, you could be someone making $1 million a year in your W-2. If you are just going to spend it all on personal things, there's probably no tax planning for you, right? Let's be honest, you're just spending it. But if you're someone making $100,000 and this is your first short-term rental, then there's absolutely things that could be done to save on, right? So it's more about your plan on wealth building. Mm-hmm. And is that something you plan to do? Or is it, you know, you're just kind of status quo in the spending mode that determines who is a candidate for tax planning?
My last question before we wrap up is, and when you're talking with a CPA, Amanda, these conversations, these strategy, because you gotta have the conversations to see if you even want to look, you know, work with them. Should you, are there consulting? Should there be fees associated with this? I know as the consumer, it's like, once you kind of have that initial meeting, you kind of feel locked in because they've spent this time. How should we be interviewing the right person? Like, should they be charging us for that strategy? What does that look like?
Well, I think every CPA firm operates a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. So it just kind of depends. I do always tell people, you know, you get what you pay for. So if it's a free consulting, you're probably not getting much true value, right? So, I mean, using us as an example, when we do tax planning with clients, it's always after they pay. Because before we meet with them, we look at all of their tax returns from the past. We look at their financial profile. We want to know, like, what do you have going on? Where are your stocks? How much? Where's your retirement account? How much do you have in it? Because only when we get an idea on our end on what's already happened, can we then be helpful in talking about what's coming up, right? The future planning of it. So, but not all firms work the same. But I will say, if you are looking for true assistance, you do want them to have a base knowledge on what's already going on, right? Spend the time ahead of time to understand about your holdings and your activities.
Mm-hmm. Great. No, that's great. I think that's something too. Everyone gets a little bit hesitant to pay for the services that they don't understand. And it's like, you gotta pay to play. I like that. You get what you pay for. So Sarah and I just went through that ourselves too, with some with some accounting help. It's like, look, what were we paying? You know, it's like we were getting what we were paying for. So be ready. Amanda, this was awesome.
So good. Amanda, thank you so much. Is there anything else you want to share before we sign off?
No, I do think 2025 is going to be an interesting year for real estate investors. You know, like I said, there's talk from the administration of bringing back 100% bonus depreciation, which could be huge for real estate. And so just making sure to keep an eye on those things, or at least have your CPA keep an eye on those things and be ready to take advantage, you know, if it does get passed.
I love that. You can follow Amanda Hahn on Instagram, and I'm sure she'll keep us abreast as well. So you can trust but verify your CPA. All right. So we will put all of Amanda's information in the show notes. Check her out. You've been so generous with your time. Amanda, we also actually have a YouTube video that where Amanda kind of made sure the information we shared was accurate, and we shared some of her opt-in there as well. So you can get to know the tax benefits of short-term rentals a little bit deeper with a print-off. So Amanda, thank you so much for your time and expertise. And with that, I am Sarah Kerr-Kane.
I'm Annette Grant, and together we are.
Thanks for visiting. Talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Thanks for Visiting podcast. Head on over to the show notes for additional information about today's episode. And please hit that subscribe button and leave us a review. Awesome reviews help us bring you awesome content. Thanks for tuning in, and we look forward to hanging out with you next week.